You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today we have two interviews. First, one with Tobias Wolff, whose new book, This Boy's Life, has just come out from the Atlantic Monthly Press. And later we'll have Doug Dutton of Dutton's Books, the first of what will be periodic profiles of people in the book community, whether they be bookstore owners or circulation librarians or constant readers of one sort or another. They're all interesting here. This Boy's Life, what seems to be possibly the first volume of a memoir by Tobias Wolff, came out this month. It's Mr. Wolff's first venture into nonfiction. His previous books have been the books of stories in the Garden of the North American Martyrs and Back in the World. He's written a novel, The Barracks Thief, that won the Penn Faulkner Award, and he's edited an anthology of contemporary fiction called Matters of Life and Death, published by a small press, I believe in Seattle. Is that correct?
It was in Green Harbor, Massachusetts then. Now they're out of Key West. The book keeps coming off the press 5 years later.
The book was published by Wampeter Press, and it was full of writers at the time that I read the anthology who were brand new to me. Now, you've been associated with a certain group of writers about whom, in the most recent issue of Granta, Carver, in a kind of beautiful memorial piece called Friendship, talks about Tobias Wolff, Richard Ford, and Carver. And Carver agrees in the piece that these three writers, while not part of a movement, share certain common interests. What would you suppose those interests to be if you agree with him?
I think that that all three of us are interested in where we came from. I don't think you could describe us as regionalists, but Elizabeth Bowen once said that everything happens somewhere. And yet to read a lot of the fiction of the 60s and early 70s, you wouldn't necessarily know that. Fiction seemed to take place in a void, the kind of void that is so dear to high school teachers who can then create for their students the idea of universality. If something happens nowhere, it must be happening everywhere. And I kind of reject that as an idea because I know that places form people. I think that's something that Ray knew very well. I think it's something that Richard knows very well. So I think we have a strong sense of place in our fiction. The place is not what the stories and novels are about, but it plays a part in them. I suppose another thing that interests us is the idea of choice, the belief that people are not determined by life but have some kind of choice to make in it that they can make for good or ill, that they have souls to lose. And I think that's something that that the three of us have in common. I could go on, but I would say those are probably the major things that we shared.
I noticed that, as compared to those novels of the 60s, that these books mark in a certain way a return to families, divided families perhaps. Yeah. But the books of the 60s, say Catch-22 was the military unit. God knows the frame of Giles Goatboy, an academic society.
Yeah, academic society, yeah. The mega university as a community, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And these really, it's almost as if people had stopped talking about families out of an inability to say what had happened. Yeah. To the family in that interim, what sorrow had split it up,
yeah,
or put things at war. Was there a reason then in turning to the nonfiction form to talk about your own family? Was that a necessity?
I wrote that not with any sense of society's need for that book, but my own but my own need to tell it. And it was a story. It's a story of my growing up. It really is not the first volume in a series of memoirs. I'm not a personage like Winston Churchill, for whom whose every action, because he's Winston Churchill, is interesting to us. It's anyway, all his actions are certainly interesting to me. I read everything about him, but this is a story about growing up, and that's what I meant it to be. The events of those years had for me, as I began to look back at them from this distance and to tell these stories to my friends, and to have a rather almost novelistic character. And I determined at a certain point that though I tried writing these things down as fiction, they were so close to me that I couldn't take the liberties of imagination that I needed to with fiction. And so I thought, well, this story wants to be told straight. This story wants to be told as it is. And then when I began telling it that way, a tremendous liberation took place, and the story just flooded out. And people have asked me, how could you remember all this, really? And my problem actually has been to cut out all the things I remembered, because with memory, everything comes attached to something else. So once I started bringing it out, it just was one thing after another. So I had to find the things that were essential in that experience, the patterns that I find replicating themselves again and again in a life, and patterns that were not just eccentric to my own existence, but things that I saw echoed in the society at large also.
This is a childhood that begins in Florida and travels to the Pacific Northwest. The book ends on the verge of enlistment in the Army. I'm curious about, in this interesting memoir, This Boy's Life, a book published by Atlantic Monthly Press, I felt like I was hearing the story of the bad boy. Now, being a good boy, which has a certain monstrousness all of its own, it was interesting to hear from the other side of the locker room. were you a bad boy?
I tried to be a bad boy. In secret, I yearned for respectability and good opinion. And I never quite legitimately could win that. And in the way that so many boys do, I thought, well, if I can't have people's respect for the good things that I do, then I will have it another way. And so I appointed myself really kind of an outlaw. I think probably not much more successful as an outlaw than I was as a good boy, but that was my pose for many years anyway. And the book really is also about, I mean, what I'm describing now is the way in which people try to find out who they are. Am I this? Am I that? I'll try this for a while. And there's a necessary process of self-invention that goes on when you're growing up. In my own case, this got taken to extremes. I manufactured an identity for myself, in fact, forged letters of recommendation, forged a school transcript in order to get myself a scholarship to a prep school back east. It worked for a while, but that act fell apart also. So for me, it was this book is a journey through different selves also. And I even changed my name a couple of times in the course of my boyhood. It's perhaps a grotesque or exaggerated version of what I think all children do.
It's interesting. Leslie Fiedler, the American literary critic, speaks a good deal in his book, Love, Death, and the American Novel, about the cult of the child, that Peck's Bad Boy, Huckleberry Finn, that there is a sense that American literature wants to be about how people do not grow up, on the one hand, and how they create a cult out of childhood, on the other. What's your attitude toward childhood?
I agree with Fiedler's assessment, and I remember George Steiner had a wonderful essay once on J.D. Salinger talking about that very question, about the way in which American writers tend to treat childhood very nostalgically as this golden age from which all other times come as a lessening, a diminution, a loss. And I do not see childhood that way. I see it in my own experience as having been pretty tough and it was a kind of hard university to go to. I'm not pleading that I was a miserable child, but I found it a confusing and hard time. And I've been progressively happier as I've gotten older, to tell you the truth, and found myself able to enter the world at large a little. I find I remember childhood as a time of extraordinary solitude. Even though I had many friends, there was an essential solitude to that time that I would not want to live through again.
In this boy's life, as you've mentioned, the subject of lying comes up crucially again and again. And I guess I wanted to speak my piece here. I noticed that in a way, as opposed to the autobiography, that lying functions in your fiction rather differently. That in the book, people lie to escape their lives, you know, as in inventing knights of old and a conqueror's life, whereas the tendency in your fiction is to lie into the center of things, mm-hmm. to lie so that things occur at the heart of a very difficult problem.
Yeah.
In other words, the difference between an evasive kind of lying and a lie that brings you to the most difficult arresting point from which to create fiction. Could you talk about the difference between lying in life and lying on the page?
Yes. Yes, the boy in the book, the boy I was a liar, and the liar, in fact, the liar in the world is not the happy creature that that we sometimes imagine him to be, and it costs the lie subtracts from the person after a while. The substance gets lost. In fiction, it's a different problem. I think what I'm talking about in fiction, when my characters sometimes reach for the truth with a lie, when they do that, I see that the conventions that we surround ourselves with, the politenesses of life, the necessary quotidian contracts that go on between people, as being camouflage. It's a kind of inky murk that we spread and that obscures the truth. And there are conventional ideas about truth that keep us from the truth, I think. And we need the imagination somehow to thrust through that, to break through that to the essential truth. And often it's in a character's moment of invention, of an abandonment of the politeness, the conventional ideas of truth that enables someone to break through to the truth. And so, yes, that's the way it functions in the imagination in my stories. In the book, I was writing about I was trying to get a little closer to the experience of an actual boy and talk about the way in which, indeed, his imagination did release him into a different world, but it also created in him terrible confusions about who he was that were very costly to him and to people around him.
In This Boy's Life, again published this month by Atlantic Monthly Press, written by Tobias Wolff, who's in the studio with me, in This Boy's Life, the chapters are structured, at least some of them, to the sections of a Boy Scout's manual, citizenship in the home, citizenship in the school, and then move on to a more spiritual kind of guide, a chapter called the Amen Corner and Amen, finally. I'm kind of curious about that way of structuring the book.
In the chapters that you mentioned, those are names of merit badges, actually. Citizenship in the home, citizenship in the school. And I was a Boy Scout, and I thirsted after that conventional respectability that this whole Scout thing invites you to have. There's a movement beyond that in the section called the Amen Corner, where I remember having, for the first time, a profound apprehension that my character was in need of mending, that I was capable of deeply and unnecessarily hurting people. And it's that movement out of yourself toward other people. It's the recognition that other people have reality that is the awakening of the spirit, I think, in a human being. And that's why that moves in that direction.
It's interesting. As a good boy whose parents forget about overnights, they wouldn't let me carve the statues out of soap because they didn't want to have me handling a knife. This is how one grows to be a bookworm. Books were the only things that were trusted. You know, anything else might produce unforeseeable results. But in the Scouts, you find a kind of code of behavior, and a lot is spoken about in the book about different kinds of codes and moralities, and I notice that there is what seems to be an implicit morality of writing. At one point, the boy in the book says that he would not do the childish thing of turning any person into a symbol. Is that...
Not now.
Not now, right.
But then.
Right. Is that implicitly an attitude toward writing itself that shows up in your work, a refusal of symbolism?
It's an attitude toward writing and toward life. I think that we look at the last 8 years. We've been making symbols out of the rest of the world. We've been having evil empires. We've been having the Satan in Libya. It seems to be very important to us to create symbols of other people, to remind ourselves of our own virtue, of our own rectitude. And it's a childish habit. Children do that. That's how they organize the world. They organize it symbolically. And I think that and they turn other people into symbols. That's excusable in a child. It's necessary in a child. As the child grows older and continues to do that, it's a form of corruption, I think.
Tobias Wolff has been reading his work around Los Angeles this past week. He's appeared at Small World Books and at Butler and Gabriel Books in Venice. And we're very lucky from time to time to have a visiting writer. How does it feel to take your work on the road? Is that a chore?
I love it while I'm doing it. Writers work in solitude. They don't know who's on the other end. When I can sit down with somebody like you who has read my book carefully and obviously put some of themselves into the reading of it, that's why I write. So it's very, very gratifying to have this contact with people who've read my books. It's really wonderful. When I go home, I collapse. I mean, it wears me out. But while I'm doing it, I mean, it's like going to a party at night, isn't it? You have so much fun that night, and then the next morning you don't. But this has been a wonderful kind of party for me.
We've been talking to Tobias Wolff about his book, This Boy's Life, and we're going to turn now to Doug Dutton, who owns Dutton's Bookstore here in Los Angeles. One of the happy things that Bookworm does is to, what would you say, wriggle around and try and cover the literary community and give people who may feel that Los Angeles is a wasteland in this regard the pleasure of knowing that there are oases punctuating the desert. And I'm happy to have Doug Dutton here with me today. Doug, when I first discovered your bookstore, I felt immediately at home, and I think, you know, struck up a conversation with you.
Oh, I remember that very well.
Because finally I was in a place, and there are very few small world Chattertons, where there were loads of small press books, a lot of poetry, surprise short story collections from university presses. I knew that I was in the company of someone who cared about books, who came from a bookish place, and I gather you come from a very literary family, several of them connected with books intimately. Who are they?
Well, my parents actually started the bookstore. I mean, just simply as lovers of reading, of collectors of books. They used to go down to the Hollywood Pickwick back in the glory days of the Hollywood Pickwick and cart me and my sister down there, and they'd put us up on the second floor, and we'd sit on the floor and go through books as they spend hours down there. And I guess it is true that it is a bookish family. My brother Dave was editor of Westways magazine for a number of years, and now he's at the North Hollywood Duttons. And I have a sister who managed a couple of bookstores, including the Mocha bookstore and the Getty Museum bookstore, and is still intimately involved in books, as am I.
Right. You are also a composer, I believe.
Right. I was trained as a composer at up at Berkeley, and I've been able to keep on composing and keep on teaching. I've been at L.A. City College for a number of years now. But the books and the bookstore has really taken over my life in the way you know that books can do that. Suddenly they're everywhere.
Oh, yes. Dutton's Bookstore is at 11975 San Vicente in Brentwood. Can a bookstore, is a bookstore a viable solution to the many people who want to be writers, composers, artists, and want some way to attain some kind of financial security? Will a bookstore do it?
Well, I'm not certain. I think the question hasn't been answered yet. We're making a go of it on San Vicente. Things are perking along there. Nobody is getting rich. Nobody from the people who come in for 4 hours a week to straighten to those who are there all the time. But there are certain compensations for working in a bookstore, one of which is the people that you get to deal with on a daily basis. And I mean, I pinch myself because I really feel lucky about that. I see more arguments standing in the checkout line at Lucky's than I will ever see in a year's time at the bookstore. And it's I think that has something to do with the nature of readers, but it's good.
You know, that's very interesting because as a reader who, what, went through his hibernation and birth in New York, the thing that would define a New York reader would be a tendency toward argumentativeness and a real thirsting. I remember the favorite bookstores in New York were places where poets of different schools would nearly have fist fights. Interesting that California has a more peaceful life for its readers.
But I mean, that's a different sort of argument. I think those are the arguments that you wait for. It's when somebody comes up to the counter and looks at a book you've got there and say, this is just a piece of junk. How could you possibly stand it? And then it starts from that point. Those are wonderful arguments. I look forward to those.
Before you moved into your store on San Vicente, it used to be a place called Brentwood Book Nook, and I remember thinking to myself, well, I won't go anywhere called Book Nook. I mean, that's not for me. They will have the books that I don't ever read. And then you took over the store, and by now the store is three times the size that it was when I began. What's come in with the expansion? What new sections came to the store?
Well, that may be Freudian, because actually I think it was just simply called the Brentwood Bookstore, or bookshop, rather. But the it had that nookish feeling about it. What we've really done is expand. It was a good small general bookstore, and we've taken philosophy, literary criticism, certainly literature, expanded them in big ways. Lots of art criticism now, serious books on words and word studies, a nature section. It just goes on and on. Recently, we put in a classical music CD and tape section, which is reflects our own defined and decided tastes, and a pretty good literary journal and magazine section, too, with some things that I can't believe are being published.
That's great. You know, one of the pleasures of the Dutton's Bookstore, for people who haven't been there, is that the people who work there, I think, with only one or two other exceptions, are the most literary and knowledgeable book people in town, I guess headed by Big Scott Wanberg, who's
poet laureate.
Poet laureate of the store, and whose rumbling, wisecracking, talking from the side of his mouth ways have led so many people to books they may not otherwise have read. And I know that the staff in general puts up a list of recommendations in the store of things that you might look at. What's on the Brentwood Dutton's book list right now?
Well, let's see. Right now, Tobias Wolff's book is certainly on that. You'll ask for that book and you have your ear chewed off by three or four people who absolutely love it. Before the news broke, Satanic Verses had been there as at least a controversial book and quite a good book from a number of viewpoints, but that stands. Parting the Waters, the Taylor Branch. Oots, Bruce Chatwin's, what looks like his last novel, and the new Margaret Atwood, Cat's Eye.
And you even have selections in different genres if people want to stray into mysteries.
From time
to time, you've recommended books to me. I'm not a mystery enthusiast or any kind of genre, but I think, what was that book called, Second Act, Second Curtain?
Second Curtain, right, by the British poet, Marxist banker, Roy Fuller. Yeah, lovely book, isn't
this
it?
This is the reason why I like to go to Brentwood Bookstore, to the Dutton's Bookstore in Brentwood, rather, because they always have something. Can you imagine that I haven't known about? And that's been a great pleasure. And also, I don't know exactly how you do it, some wonderful used books in among the shelves. Are you still doing the trade in used books?
Sure, sure are. But, Michael, I want to say that part of the reason, you understand, is when people like yourself will come into the bookstore, ask for a book, or tell us about a book. I mean, it's I like to think of it as a forum as much as just a place where we do business. And you certainly have turned me on. You were the first person to tell me about David Levitt, for example, as a stylist, and that was most interesting. So.
David Levitt is going to be on the show in a couple of weeks, as
wonderful,
a matter of fact,
wonderful,
with his new book, Equal Affection. That brings us, though, to the question of the clientele of a bookstore. I am not going to utter the names of people I've sometimes seen in the store, but one of the things I like about the Brentwood Bookstore is that, for some reason, it is unique among Los Angeles bookstores in that it seems to be at the center of a community of literary and theatrical and articulate people who come to the store regularly as customers. I found a well-known songwriter searching for more Ford Madox Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Is it an ongoing interaction with the shopping community that makes the store so home-like,
certainly,
and comfortable?
Certainly. I mean, there's a whole electricity that takes place there. And, of course, it's good to do that with the new books, but it's also wonderful to see that certain well-known songwriter buying the complete works of Balzac as something to do on the road. Or another well-known actress yesterday buying Verve magazine in its Rizzoli reincarnation.
We will be continuing to talk to the owners of bookstores, the publishers of small presses, all sorts of literary aspects of Los Angeles on Bookworm. And as we continue these happy conversations, I remain your humble bookworm, Michael Silverblatt. We've been talking to Douglas Dutton of Brentwood Bookstore of Dutton's Bookstore in Brentwood, and before that to Tobias Wolff, author of This Boy's Life from Atlantic Monthly Press, just out this month. Thank you for joining me.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse.
You're listening to KCRW Santa Monica, a community service of Santa Monica College at 89.9 FM, National Public Radio for most of Southern California.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.